Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. We're going to do some cool stuff today. Alina, who have you got on?
We have got on today Ben Hodges, who is currently a PhD student at the University of Northampton. He's working on British Army intelligence during the interwar period. He himself has had a very diverse career working on intelligence and security. So today, we're going to be speaking more about intelligence in the interwar period and the start of, guess what, the Second World War. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for the introduction.
God, I'm really looking forward to this. So tell us about the interwar period and the 10-year rule. What is it and how does intelligence fit into it?
Well, obviously the interwar period is a period of time between the two world wars. Mm. And is a period of time where a lot of the sort of thinking at the time was that we wouldn't want another war and we would do all we could to try and avoid it. So in 1919, somebody called Winston Churchill, who you may have heard of,
proposed
the idea that that there would be no major war involving the British Army for 10 years. And then in 1932, I think it was, that's when they finally realised that they might have got it a bit wrong. So what it meant was that all the sort of planning assumptions for budget, for equipment, for anything like that, was all based on the idea that they wouldn't have to fight a major war. They accepted that they still had their various commitments around the empire and places like that, but they wouldn't have to go to the continent to fight a big war. Obviously, we now know that that was somewhat flawed. But the result of that, for intelligence purposes, was that intelligence was very much starved of funds. Douglas Haig, again, you may have heard of, he said that intelligence was fine, but it was something that was really only useful during wartime, and there really wasn't a role for intelligence during peacetime. To that end, every year during the interwar period, the British Army would publish its sort of army estimates to say how much it was going to spend on stuff. And I discovered that the princely fee of £100 per annum was to be spent on field intelligence, which in itself sounds pathetic, which it probably was. However, when I dug a little further, I discovered that this wasn't even being spent. It was just a notional fee being put into the accounts to say, we've considered that we might need to spend some money on intelligence. However, this will only be spent on intelligence during wartime. It's not necessarily a peacetime thing.
Intelligence doctrine. It sounds so boring. Tell us what it is.
Just say what you really feel, Alina.
They do say honesty is the best policy.
Yeah.
It does sound boring, and for a lot of people it is. So doctrine is essentially the sort of how-to guide. So militaries produce doctrine which explains how they do certain tasks, and there are doctrines for literally every single task that you could imagine that the army would commit to. So for intelligence purposes, the main sort of publication during that time was the Manual of Military Intelligence in the Field, which was published in 1922. Now, this incorporated a lot of the lessons that had been learned from the First World War. And this was then revised several times during this period. But ultimately, it is a how-to guide. It explains how people go about doing the job of intelligence, which is something that, you know, that a lot of people have struggled with over the years, looking at the way the British Army operates. There's been a sort of sense that the British Army has been loath to fully embrace doctrine. The sort of the stereotypical view is the Germans were all very much into, you know, staff work and it all being ruthlessly efficient and everything being planned to the nth degree, whereas the British tended to have a bit more of a lackadaisical approach to following guidelines like doctrine.
What kind of people do they recruit for intelligence in this period?
Well, a lot of this period was spent looking at the idea that they might need somebody in the future, but we wouldn't necessarily need someone now. So the British Army created a sort of reserve, regular army reserve of officers. Within that, they split it down into different sections. So there was an intelligence section. And what they tried to do was they tried to sort of encapsulate all the experience of the First World War by encouraging former intelligence officers to join this list during the period. Now, the problem with this was that a lot of people obviously were getting on a bit. And indeed, in the First World War, a lot of the intelligence officers were older than your average soldier. So consequently, as the period went on, people tended to drop off the list because they just became too old to serve anymore. So good idea in theory. In reality, I don't think it actually produced that many officers. But in terms of the sort of people they recruited, there were sort of two or three things they really went for. So they were massively into language skills. So people who spoke fluent French and German, particularly welcome, other more sort of exotic languages too. And because of that, and again, it's actually mentioned in the manual, the sort of people they're looking for are people like teachers, people who have had clerical jobs, because obviously the importance of good, orderly clerical work is sacrosanct to intelligence. Journalists, quite a few journalists ended up in there. And then as time went on, they became a little bit more concerned about the prospect of war. They then created a thing called the Army Officer Emergency Reserve, which was essentially a pool of people who put their hands up and said, do you know what, if there's a war, I'm quite happy to be mobilised and to do my bit. They weren't paid, they were provided with no uniform. It was literally just a list of people that were good chaps.
That's mad. I love it. Can you imagine now, everyone would be like, well, what can I bill you for?
Yeah, it's strange, really. I mean, one of the criticisms at the time was that people said, well, do you know what? A decent person should do this anyway. There was a sense that sense of duty should have been ingrained in all of us. Mm. So why do we actually need to have this list? But nonetheless, it did actually produce some interesting characters that would eventually go on to serve in the Second World War.
So how did they find these people?
There was a branch within the War Office that called MI1X, which was responsible for creating a list of these sort of people. Now, they relied heavily on networking and patronage. You know, there was a lot of sort of going to certain clubs and knowing the right people. And I knew a chap who did this, or I knew a chap who served in the last war. So very, very ad hoc, informal networks. One of the sort of major networks that sort of produced a lot of good work was the friendship between Vernon Kell, who was the head of MI5, and an intelligence staff officer called Kenneth Strong, who would eventually end up being Eisenhower's chief intelligence officer. They realised that there was a requirement for intelligence and security staff in the event of war. So in the late 30s, they got together and they said, right, we need to come up with an idea of training some people. Now, at the time, there was no intelligence corps depot or anything like that, so it was all done under the auspices of the Corps of Military Police. But again, in typical fashion, Kenneth Strong said, oh yeah, I know this guy. I worked with him in Germany. He speaks French and German. He's a good guy. A guy called Frank Davis. Unfortunately, Frank Davis actually left the army and retired. So they managed to convince him to come back. Initially, he wasn't even paid at all. Then he was paid as a sort of contractor. And eventually, about a year or so after he'd set up the field security wing, they managed to sort of get him in through the back door, and he was recommissioned as a major. And he'd subsequently ended up as lieutenant colonel and was the sort of first commandant of the newly formed intelligence corps. The other side of it that was quite successful was this list that was created by lieutenant colonel Gerald Templer, who was later a field marshal. He literally sat down with his clerk and drew up lists of the right sort of people, and then contacted them and invited them to come and do training and to do intelligence work.
Are there women?
Again, there were, but they were in your stereotypical clerical roles. One of the women who worked as a clerk within the War Office, who was working with Gerald Templer on the list, was a lady called Joan Bright Astley, who wrote an autobiography in the 70s talking about her experiences at the War Office. And it does seem extremely stereotypical that these are the sort of the bright young girls who can do typing and talk the talk and look the part. But she was involved in helping set up the intelligence training courses that occurred. which again were all very ad hoc, run through the auspices of the Royal United Services Institute in London. But then weirdly, people had to actually pay for their place on the course. So, you know, you get selected to be an intelligence officer, and then they turn around and say, yeah, but that's going to cost you to do that training course.
Mm. Alex, I don't think you and I would be very welcome at this point.
No, probably not.
Well, you speak Polish.
You do speak Polish, and you also run a motorbike, Lena, and motorbikes were the big thing. There was this absolute obsession with motorcycles and intelligence work, because I think the idea was that they expect people to be careering all over the battlefield, passing on messages to different sort of formation commanders.
I reckon I'd be in an office, like, French, can read Russian, bit of Italian, bit of Spanish, learning Arabic.
I think they'd sat your hand off.
You reckon?
Yeah, you're well in there.
Oh, my only problem is I'd have to, like, you know, if they're giving you source material and stuff, if people talk too fast with most of them, I'd be screwed. As long as I can slow the tapes down to interpret, I'm fine. Or if it's reading the stuff, I'm fine.
I'm happy being on that battlefield on that motorbike. That kind of sounds fun.
God help the battlefield is all I can say.
But you can always sit on the back. I mean, our cartoon's a little bit wrong with you sitting on the front and me on the back.
You're never going to get over that, are you?
No, I'm never going to get over that. I'm really sorry, Steve. I can't get over it.
That's why I've told him not to change it, just because I know it winds you up. But seriously, though, the way you've been explaining this to us, it's a bit, I want to use the word clusterfuck, it's a mess, isn't it? There's not a lot of doctrine, if you like, about how to set this out and how to make it work as an effective machine. Or am I interpreting it wrong? What kind of blunders are made?
No, I think you've pretty much nailed it there. It's one of those situations where they had a sort of grand plan, which would be the doctrine. But then no one really actually had the impetus to actually follow through with it. Everything was based around budgetary decisions, and there was this general consensus and general thought that intelligence work was only became important when there was actually a war on. For example, there were two large British Army exercises that took place in this period. So one was in 1925, and the other was in 1935. And only in the 1935 exercise did they actually bother to exercise any of the intelligence staff. There was no intelligence input at all into the 1925 exercise. And obviously with this obsession with motorbikes I was talking about as well, the other thing that happened was lots of intelligence personnel had motorbike accidents. And in fact, if you go to the Military Intelligence Museum, so here's my opportunity to plug the museum.
Please do.
Which is currently shut for COVID, but that's the kind of the story of everyone's life at the moment. Mm. But if you go there, they actually have a Second World War motorcycle and a display dedicated to all the intelligence corps soldiers who were killed in road traffic accidents.
So Germany now invades Poland. For those who need to know the date, that's the 1st of September 1939. France then falls. For those who need to know, that's at some point in June 1940. What happens then?
Well, amazingly, despite the ad hoc nature of the intelligence work leading up to the war and the work of the British Expedition Force in France, by a miracle, they managed to actually put a number of intelligence corps sections into the British Expedition Force under the auspices of a thing called the Field Security Police, which was run by the Corps of Military Police, because there wasn't actually an intelligence corps at that stage. Now, they performed reasonably well considering the overall performance of the British Expeditionary Force and the collapse of sort of command and control towards the end. But when they all evacuated from Dunkirk and the dust settled, there was a decision that intelligence would expand rapidly because there was a war on. Someone had finally noticed that we were actually fighting a war. So to that end, in July 1940, the decision was made to form an intelligence corps, the intelligence corps we know and love today. This year, the corps celebrates its 80th anniversary. So there were lots of great plans for lots of corps-related activity for the 80th, but unfortunately, COVID has kind of ruined all that. So on the 19th of July, 1940, Army Order 112 created the intelligence corps. And this really represented the start of a sort of professionalisation of intelligence. A lot of people said before that, you know, this was about esprit de corps, but from my research, it's mainly due to administration. They realised that vast numbers of intelligence officers, intelligence NCOs in sections all throughout the army needed some sort of central hub in which to operate, to be paid, to be trained. And that sort of was the main driving force behind it getting its own cat badge and all the stuff that goes with being a proper formed unit.
I know you get a little annoyed sometimes with certain terminologies when it comes down to intelligence. So let's straighten out a few of these. First of all, is a spy an intelligence officer? He's laughing as if to say, I'm laughing, but I'm not laughing.
I'm laughing, but this comes up all the time. So I think we'll try and do a little bit of definitional work here. Mm-hmm. So intelligence officers are members of intelligence services, or they are appointments within the army. The difference between an intelligence officer and, say, a spy is that a spy could be an intelligence officer if they are operating against their own country, or they could just be another member of the armed forces or a member of the government who is collecting intelligence against their own people. Then, just to muddy the waters further, you also have agents. Now, in the UK, an agent is somebody who is a paid informant. They may be paid to spy on somebody or something. But in the US, an agent is also an actual full-time employee of an intelligence agency. So it does get very confusing. The popular press always likes to refer to anybody in sort of senior intelligence positions in government as, you know, UK top spy says, and that sort of thing. But ultimately, intelligence officers are employees. Spies are kind of not. That is a really shit explanation.
Yeah.
That's all right. Don't worry.
Oh, it's okay to admit that it's a nightmare.
We've got our own nightmares and minefields all the time. So, because we went through a couple of these, actually, because I just thought I'd annoy you just for fun.
She does it so well.
I do it so well. Right, okay. Are you ready for this one?
Sure.
I'm just going to read a statement. Apparently, there was no intelligence between 1918 and 1940. And go.
Oh, God. This is like the sort of popular historiography of the Intelligence Corps. The idea that the Intelligence Corps was disbanded at the end of the First World War and then reformed in 1940, and that between that period of time, the army did no intelligence whatsoever because it didn't have an intelligence corps, which is absolute bollocks. Because
Say it, Ben. Say it how you mean it.
There
was still an intelligence function. The army still required intelligence. It just didn't have a separate corps providing personnel. And also, the intelligence corps wasn't disbanded in 1918, despite what, at one point, the own British Army's website said. It kind of withered on the vine and sort of died in about 1929, having got smaller and smaller and smaller. I think the last sort of section to leave occupied Germany was sort of, you know, a couple of officers, a couple of clerks, and, you know, maybe a dog and a bicycle.
Yeah, I was going to say there'd be a dog, definitely, that they'd adopted from somewhere.
And probably a motorbike as well.
Yeah.
We're loving our motorbike.
They're everywhere.
Oh, here's another one for you. I'm going to say something really witty and funny now that I bet you've never heard. Military intelligence is an oxymoron.
Oh, yeah. No, no. I looked into this, and the origin of this saying is actually attributed to Groucho Marx. However, I also discovered from doing a bit more digging that apparently Charters, who was Haig's intelligence officer in the First World War, quite controversial.
That is a little bit of an oxymoron, but yeah, let's carry on.
But yeah, he apparently, when he was talking about talking to Lord Curzon about intelligence work, he was quoted as saying, "I fancy military intelligence to him is a contradiction in terms."
Yeah, but that's Curzon. I mean, God, he wasn't exactly uncontroversial himself, was he?
No, I mean, if you're talking about two controversial figures talking about something slightly controversial, it's going to go that way, isn't it?
Just a little bit. We won't make you dwell on that one anymore because it is silly.
Thanks.
So this is the one that I kind of thought would be fun because let's throw this into the mix. And I know what's going to come out of Alex's mouth in just a moment. So let me read this first, and then Alex, you can go full on. Right, if you could go for a martini, darling, with any spy or intelligence officer, who would it be and why?
Can I just tell you now, right, the whole James Bond martini thing is a crock of shit. As someone who was a cocktail bartender for many, many, many years, you know when he stands there all poncy and goes, shaken, not stirred? Do you know the difference, right? You shake a martini, you water it down. You stir it, you don't. So basically, he's ordering a weak fucking martini and being snotty about it.
That's right, Martin Crowe. You ruined Bond for me now.
Oh, mate, this is why. Do you know what? That's basically the reason I've never sat through a Bond film, because I'm like, you're snooty and you shouldn't be. Yeah, he's ordering a weakened martini. If he was badass, he'd ask stirred, not shaken. Sorry, I've just ruined that for you, haven't I?
Yeah, I'm never
going to. Just silence. Anyway, if you were going to have a decent martini with a spy or intelligence officer, who would it be and why?
This will make several people who know me laugh quite a lot, actually, because the person I'd go for is someone who was active during the interwar period and during the Second World War, but whose treachery was not discovered until well after the war.
Uh-oh. And
that's Guy Burgess.
I thought it might be one of them.
Now, what I find fascinating about Guy Burgess is he is the most inappropriate person to hold any sort of security clearance or be involved in any sort of sensitive work whatsoever. He is a predatory homosexual alcoholic. I mean, every alarm bell should possibly ring about this guy's personality.
At the time, definitely.
Should have prevented him from ever working in intelligence. However, you know, the chap went to Eton and Cambridge. So, I mean, he's obviously a good chap. That's all that matters.
Sounds like Boris Johnson's government, doesn't it?
Wait, hold on a minute. Just because he went to Eton?
Yeah, that's pretty much how security vetting worked in those days. If you were the right sort of chap and you went to the right school and went to the right university and you had the right references, then that was pretty much okay.
Is it not how it works for A-level results this year as well?
It's making up, don't they?
Yeah. Obviously, we're not saying that there's anything untrustworthy about homosexuals, are we? But we're saying at the time that would have been an alarm bell, wouldn't it?
And absolutely. It should, you know, the fact that it was illegal meant that he was already having to live a double life. Although, Guy Burgess was such an interesting character in the sense that he was so openly gay in a time when it was really not a good idea to be openly gay.
Yeah, and then you would have think that would have made them, like, not in the way that they thought would have made them not want to have him in a position, as you say, of intelligence with security clearance.
Yeah. But I'd definitely go for a drink with him. I mean, you know it'd be a good laugh because he's an alcoholic, so you'll definitely get the rounds in.
Yeah, definitely. Alina, Alex, what about you?
I was going to jump in there and say, Alex, what about you?
Well, I'm going World War One, and I'm going for Walter George Fletcher, who was an Etonian. He was a teacher there by the time the war broke out, and he's in my Eton book, and I adore him. And he ran away from school, and these three poor teachers, language masters, so he taught French and German, got given these really stupid, not trustworthy motorcycles, told they were in the intelligence corps, got shipped over to France before literally anyone, and basically spent the retreat bumbling around on a motorbike. At one point, he rode his motorbike into a crowd of German officers, and basically they realised he was about to be caught because he was in a British uniform, and then just shouted at them in German and rode away before they could figure out what was going on. He was brilliant and lovely, and he was killed in March 15, and he's in the front row of the cemetery at Bois Grenier. But I'd love to have a drink with him because he, when he was drunk, he used to sing German opera, and he was mad. So yeah, I named my cat after him. I named two cats, one after him and one after his brother. So yeah, that's like pretty personal for me. That's who I'd choose. I'd ask him, because his letters home, when he says about being in the intelligence corps, he just is like, I don't even know what the intelligence corps is at this point in 1914. I don't know what I'm a part of. So in the end, he just attaches himself to the 19th Brigade, which was like operating separately from a division, and just says, oh, fuck it, I'm just staying here. I don't have a clue what's going on at this point.
No, that's common with a lot of people's experience in the First World War with the intelligence corps. You know, people really didn't really understand what it was all about, and you know, the sort of the temporary gentlemen who found their way into the corps in 1914 really knew nothing about soldiering whatsoever. And again, a lot of the stories revolve around falling off motorbikes. And I think two of the questions that were asked of soldiers, of officers joining in 1914 was, can you ride a motorbike and can you ride a horse?
The brilliant thing is he desperately, desperately wanted a horse. And so everywhere he goes in France and Belgium, he's trying to catch a horse so he can get rid of the motorbike and nobody's having it. He has this romantic view of himself riding across France and Belgium on a bloody horse, and he gets given this motorbike, which he basically just ends up kicking and swearing at a lot.
You know, the other really odd thing as well, Alex, is that I named my cat after Guy Burgess.
Did you? Oh, yeah. I have George and Reggie. So his brother, this is what else is brilliant, is George gets put out there so quickly. He has a younger brother who's basically looks like a 1920s film star, is stunning, and has a personality of Blackadder, who was already in the artillery section of the Oxford OTC and was wanting to get out really quickly. And George ended up there with no experience bar being in the Eton OTC, and a heart condition, ends up there before him, which is quite funny because his brother didn't really see the funny side of it. But yeah. You should all name your cats after historical figures. And my current cat is Bertie, who is named after George the Sixth.
My dog is named after a historical character.
Nero.
Emperor Nero. Not that has anything to do with this, but...
Who's Teddy named after then?
Oh, well, Teddy wasn't, but I do theoretically have a third dog, and he's called Titus.
Just randomly naming them after Roman figures.
I'm probably petless, so I can't really join in at the moment, because Burgess is long gone.
Oh, that's sad. Alina, spy, who would you sit with? Or intelligence officer, because they're not the same thing.
Because they're not the same thing. So, we've already had a podcast about who I really would like to sit with, and that's Kristina Skarberg, because she's awesome. But when I don't want to talk about her, because we've had a whole podcast on her, and she's awesome. But instead, I'm going to give you a code name, and let's see if you all, probably Ben knows who it is. But if I say to you, tricycle, who is it?
I haven't got a clue what you're talking about.
Ben?
Just going to admit it.
No, because you can make me look stupid now. I know the code name, but I can't remember the story.
Dusko Popov.
Yes, we talked about this, yes.
Yeah, so actually I would have a drink with him because he's one of Ian Fleming's kind of inspirations, funny enough, for James Bond. But no, that's not the reason why I'd have a drink with him, because he's kind of, I mean... We had this discussion earlier that, like, all intelligence officers and spies were womanizers. But I think he kind of takes the number one position for all of this.
Oh, do you know what? You've just made me think I would... Aubrey Herbert as well, who was supposedly the inspiration for Green Mantle, Buchan. So he was blind, practically blind, bugger all military experience, and got to World War One at the beginning by just going to an outfitter's, buying an Irish Guards uniform and marching out and hoping no one noticed that he was with them. He did get a horse, not a motorbike, but he ended up... So first of all, he was with... the Irish Guards, then he was wounded, then he was in Cairo. He went with T. Lawrence to try and negotiate the surrender of Kut. He also landed with the New Zealand division on at Gallipoli. He's just everywhere and hilarious and brilliant and takes the mickey out of everyone, and I think he would be great to have a drink.
Yeah, I think the thing that sort of comes out to me from doing all this research is that intelligence tends to attract slightly eccentric characters. Which again will make anyone who knows me laugh, because I do kind of fit that that sort of category sometimes. But I've come across some fascinating people and with some really diverse experience as well. I mean, there was one guy whose name escapes me right now, which is typical while I'm talking to you. But he'd served in sort of Swaziland before the First World War, and then he found his way into the intelligence corps in the First World War. And then during the interwar period, he spent a bit of time with MI6 and spent a little bit of time working with the Foreign Office and then working in business and just, you know, traveling all around the world doing odd jobs. By the end of the Second World War, because he got recalled again for service, you know, he was a sort of still serving as a 68-year-old lieutenant colonel in the intelligence corps.
Brilliant.
Photograph of him. I mean, he looks absolutely ancient, but he's just had so much random experience.
That's awesome. Obviously, you'd want to sit down with T. Lawrence as well and find out about all that nonsense about swimming the Gulf of Aqaba and stuff like that, and to what extent he was actually doing intelligence work before the war as well. I'd love to get that out of him.
You'd also have to talk to him about motorbikes as well and just maybe suggest that he perhaps doesn't ride one.
Slows around going around corners.
Yeah.
Sorry, is that a bit disrespectful? No. But yeah, he was a bit... No, but he was killed in a motorcycle accident, Alina.
See, most schools and military intelligence, they go hand in hand, but they're also really dangerous.
They are very dangerous. They're still very dangerous.
Oh, don't ask. Talk to Alina about people that ride around in their shorts and t-shirts. She gets really angry.
Yeah, or even, as well.
Do you know what? Even worse. Do you want to know what's even worse about that? When you have a guy who's fully kitted out, leather, helmet, gloves, everything, and he's got his little dolly on the back in a little dress with her legs bare, her arms bare, barely a proper helmet on. I can't look at it.
It's because you read that horror story of that woman in LA. Didn't you, who fell off and got dragged?
Yeah.
There we anyway, go. Be safe on motorbikes, people, even if you are an intelligence officer.
Especially if you're an intelligence officer, I'd say, because they seem to do a lot of accidents.
Or a spy.
Yeah, which could be the same thing.
An agent, which may or may not be the same thing. See, I've learned stuff today.
Hopefully other people have too.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for coming and talking to us all about this, Ben. It's been brilliant.
Thank you. It's been an honour to join you two, and thanks for everything you've done over the last few months of lockdown and all that other crap, because it's been hard work.
Yeah, I think lockdown may be coming again, hence why we were doing 30 recordings this week, just in case. But yeah, no, brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And join us on Monday when Andy Chatterton will be with us to talk all about resistance in Britain in World War II. I thought he was a loon when he first contacted us, but actually what he's talking about is the rather advanced planning that went on about what to do in the event that the Nazis actually made landfall and Operation Sea Lion was successful. So don't miss that. Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.